You are about to participate in the most ambitious culinary experiment ever imagined.
This competition is going to test everything.
Adapt quickly to anything. I mean anything. The wildest day of your life starts right now.
All new 24 and 24 Last Chef Standing. Sunday night at 8 on Food Network. Stream on Max.
What kind of a show are you guys putting on here today?
You're not interested in art?
No.
Now look, we're going to do this thing. We're going to have a conversation.
From Chicago, this is Film Spotting. I'm Michael Phillips.
And I'm Josh Larson. Where'd you get that girl? She's hot.
I got her yesterday.
Yesterday?
Yeah. I rode my bike over to a cemetery nearby. Her boyfriend just died.
And suddenly, I'm hungry for meatloaf.
Hey, Ma, the meatloaf!
The new film from director Lars von Trier, Nymphomaniac, has inspired this week's Film Spotting Top 5, sex-obsessed movie characters. Will Ferrell's Chaz from Wedding Crashers is doing the catering.
It's so great to hear Will Ferrell up against Lars von Trier.
Someday they'll work together.
Von Trier's Nymphomaniac comes to theaters in two parts and features Uma Thurman, Christian Slater, and Shia LaBeouf. Our review, the top 5, and more.
Mmm, good meatloaf.
Ahead on Film Spotting.
This episode of Film Spotting is brought to you by Film Spotting listeners, including new $5 a month subscriber Aaron in Decorah, Iowa, Silver Club donor David R. in Chicago, and Jennifer L. in Toronto. Thanks as well to all of our monthly donors. For more information about supporting the show, visit filmspotting.net and click on Donate. You're listening to Film Spotting. I'm Josh Larson. Michael Phillips is in for Adam Kempinar this week. Michael and I try and avoid embarrassing flashbacks to our adolescence when we get into this week's top 5 sex-obsessed movie characters. That's later in the show.
But first, director Lars von Trier has certainly favored florid movie titles of late. Melancholia was his last film, preceded by a little picture known as Antichrist. His latest, Nymphomaniac.
As a young girl, I discovered I was a nymphomaniac.
That's nothing to smile about.
If you have wings, why not fly?
If I asked you to take my virginity, would that be a problem?
Why not see a problem?
What if it's nasty and you just think of a bag of chocolate sweeties?
I wanted to be picked up, put down, again and again. I wanted to be treated like a thing.
May I tell you something?
Sure.
You're my first one.
Really?
I love you.
And was starting to have trouble remembering who was who.
I've thought about you often. Have you thought of me?
Wow.
Would it be all right if I show the children the whoring bed?
You can't make an omelette without breaking a few eggs.
In an apparent effort to make up for the relative gentility of Melancholia, I mean, Kirsten Dunst lying naked on a rock is so bourgeois, director Lars von Trier comes out guns blazing and penises dangling with Nymphomaniac, an insistently provocative and sexually explicit drama starring Charlotte Gainsbourg. We first meet Jo, the title character played by Gainsbourg, lying bloody and beaten in an alley, where a kindly older man, played by Stellan Skarsgård, discovers her and offers to let her recover in his nearby apartment. Once there, she recounts her life as a nymphomaniac going back to childhood and told in flashback by von Trier. Stacey Martin plays the younger version of Jo. For release purposes, Nymphomaniac has been divided into two volumes, which has been especially interesting as a critical exercise. I thought the first volume was compelling enough to have me anticipating the next installment, though I was leery of where things might go, given von Trier's penchant for punishing endings. Michael, I know you liked Volume 1 as well, but had similar concerns heading into Volume 2. So did your worst fears come true with the second installment, and where do you finally stand on Nymphomaniac as a whole?
It's easier to describe that than where I stand on Nymphomania as a whole.
Well, good. But, we don't need you to do
no,
that.
No, we don't need it. I did feel that this second volume, Josh, was punitive in the ways that a lot of people were dreading, as you say. It's you have a very strange picture in the first one, I think, and a not uninteresting one. You have a movie that's half the first volume is a series of two-person encounters in this apartment. It's essentially like watching a play, you know, starring the older male character and the younger female character. Skarsgård and Gainsborough, and it's very kind of, you know, old-fashioned, conventionally structured, and the chapters of her life are spun out for us as chapters in a book or kind of a fairy tale, this erotic fairy tale. Although it's anti-erotic really more than anything, because I found this film about as sexy as, you know, this taping.
Insulting. Yeah.
But it's not. Von Trier is just this incorrigible, sort of aggravating adolescent as a sensibility. And yet, Von Trier is enough of a filmmaker that when you get the sequences outside the apartment in the flashback where you see the relationship between Joe and the Shia LaBeouf character and various other men, hundreds of men in her life, it's not, you're rarely stranded in simply inside Von Trier's head for very long, because he, as I say, he's enough of a filmmaker to actually show you and maybe to some degree dramatize these sort of erotic daydreams or fever dreams or obsessions he has. I found the most compelling film in this sort of, you know, raging subconscious vein, and maybe that's all of Von Trier's work, but especially along these themes of sexual obsession and, you know, self-loathing and the rest of it, to be The First Hour of Antichrist. I think we've talked about this, Josh. I think The First Hour of Antichrist, before the violence gets outrageously explicit and grotesque, is probably the craftiest thing he's ever had to say about his idea of the world's worst marriage. You know, I think if you have these two characters in that film, it was Charlotte Gainsbourg and Willem Dafoe, who also returns here for Nymphomaniac. I just find that to be just kind of an exquisite, sick joke of a movie. And it is seriously beautiful as movie making. I don't get the same kind of highs in any kind of visual or thematic sense from part one, and I especially, Josh, didn't get it from what I saw of part two. Now, here's my caveat. I had a streaming, this is a, like a technical idiot confession. I only saw two-thirds of the second volume, so I'm unable to, at this point anyway, to talk about it properly and fully, because I haven't seen it. But what I've saw of volume two, Josh, and I'd like to hear what you have to say about this, it just kind of rolls out the most painful and difficult to watch sequences where we're talking about, you know, S&M scenes with Jamie Bell as this, you know, whip-wielding dominator. Those were the toughest sits for the movie for me, and couldn't really bear to watch some of it.
Yeah.
And it's, you know, why is that my threshold and other things aren't, you know, I don't know. But that we all have a threshold where we simply don't want to watch anymore, and that was mine.
Yeah, the unpleasantness certainly increases as Volume 2 goes on. I think Antichrist is a good point of comparison, even though it's a shorter film. But the first portion of Antichrist was about something. It was about this couple's grief. It was also about how sexuality played into their therapy, really perverse therapy that the husband puts her under. And sick joke is the right phrase as well, because it does become that. It's like the movie wants to distance itself eventually from what it's interested in as it goes on in Antichrist. And so the end just falls apart completely for me. And that is similar to what happened with his entire Nymphomaniac project. Volume one, I was fairly intrigued. I mean, I think it's certainly not erotic. That's correct as well. But I do think that it was interested in certain things that it was using its explicitness to get at. I mean, that it explores desire, certainly, but also shame and guilt and sexuality, obviously, and love. It's looking at that, too. And it's doing it in a way that the explicitness kind of falls by the wayside eventually, and the ideas rise to the top. By being so in our face in volume one, you're eventually able to set that aside and not be so shocked by it or appalled or trying to figure out, well, is that really Shia LaBeouf in that scene? Because you're a little more interested in the ideas at play. And I think those dialogue scenes between Gainsborough and Skarsgård are very good, and they help us do that because that's what they're doing. They're exploring in their conversations, which do get comically philosophical at certain points, but they're still exploring, what might this all mean? What does this mean for her as a character? What does it mean for us as viewers in the audience? And that made the film itself intriguing to me. And it was more interested in her than her actions, let me put it that way. Mm-hmm. And volume two seemed to make this progression where it was more interested in what she must now pay for those actions.
Exactly, exactly. And this is where Von Trier always goes, breaking the waves and, you know, Manderley and all the rest. But there's an awful lot of, you know, sexual punishment going on and sort of a, I don't want to say a gleeful sadism, because he's not necessarily exhibiting a lot of glee in what's happening to these mostly female protagonists. But Von Trier is, I think, still right to the degree he's a film artist worth taking seriously. And I think, you know, despite the fact that he's 14 years old and always will be in terms of his sensibility, in terms of being an idiot who shoots his mouth off about making Nazi jokes at the Cannes Film Festival and getting him kicked out of the festival, he's his own worst enemy in a sense. And he's, I think, the most clearly divided, interesting filmmaker on the world scene right now. He is his own worst enemy in every picture. And when you get a film like Antichrist, where the first half is so interesting, I think, and so and risky and beautifully acted by Gainsbourg, and that you really, when he starts kind of working against himself and just sort of indulging his worst violent and erotic, not necessarily erotic, but sexually explicit daydreams, you're just getting kind of a joke, you know. It's a different kind. It's not wit. It's just a joke. And what I found in volume two, I guess, with this one, Josh, with Nymphomania, is that Gainsbourg is an actress who forces you to take a character's situation seriously, because she doesn't have a lot of levity in her screen presence. I mean, there is no kind of distancing effect or jokey remove. That's all up to Von Trier. So the contrast with those two is very interesting, and that's a very, you know, it's a very, very intriguing kind of actress-director pairing, and that's why I think they must bring out something in each other. But in Volume 2, I just find all the kind of punishment, whether it fits the alleged crime or not, ridiculous and just sort of easy and cynical in a way.
You know what it is? It's puritanical. I mean, that's the irony of both Antichrist and this film, is that they feature these sexually volatile female characters, and in the end, it concludes that there must be punishment for the behavior, even though Volume 1 goes at lengths, and I thought this was interesting too, to not shame the Joe character for her actions. I mean, Seligman, the Skarsgård character, repeatedly says he doesn't believe in sin. Any guilt she has is a deception of religion, and so the movie is going out of its way to say, we're going to frame this outside of the usual discussions of good or bad, even though she at one point says, I'm a bad person. The movie wants to let us think about this in different terms. And that was intriguing. But suddenly in Volume 2, no, there is judgment that must be made. The judgment is that she has done wrong and must be punished. And what's lost there, it goes beyond what you want to make of her decisions and her actions. But what's lost is the humanity of the character and any interest in her that might be some sort of empathy or any understanding. That Volume 2 no longer wants to understand her at all. And I just found that there was less for me to dig into at that point. Now, you said you weren't able quite to finish it, so you think you have about a half hour left. I'm wondering how much punishment you were spared.
How much more do I want to go through? I mean, this is a ridiculous position to be in, to be talking about it without having quite seen it all. But in a funny way, it sort of tests your interest in seeing a guy fulfill his 4-hour-plus project about just kind of like ticking through the chapters of this nymphomaniac's life, as he calls her. But I'll be seeing the whole thing later tonight or tomorrow. But what I'm finding so far is, especially when you get into the area that will be treated in a much more glossy and audience-friendly way in 50 Shades of Grey, where you get into the administering of pain and punishment and physical, you know, whips and chains and all the rest of it, that I find that when a filmmaker decides to go that route, when you're taking a character through the darkest night of her soul, right? You know, finding the degradation that will somehow bring her back up out of it again and reconnect her with her sexual life and her ordinary life. That's the cheap and easy way to just illustrate it, I think. I don't find it interesting dramatically, and I guess I just find that what little Von Trier professes to understand or be truly curious about in relation to women and women's sexuality, I think it's out the window in those scenes, because those are just the same old SHIP, frankly.
The idea was a competition. We were to go on a train trip. B said there was no need for tickets. The one who had the most men when we reached the destination would win the chocolate sweet.
Interrupt here. What you were doing when you walked down that corridor, you were reading the river.
Most of the large fish stay sheltered from the current to save energy and to hide from the prey. Where the fish hides in the stream entails a very complicated hierarchy.
You're listening to Film Spotting. I'm Josh Larson here with Michael Phillips of the Chicago Tribune. We're talking about Lars von Trier's Nymphomaniac, Volume 1, and about three quarters of Volume 2. But maybe we should get to something that occurs, at least I thought it was more prominent in the first part of Volume 2, and you can speak to it more directly. And it's this idea of the movie becoming more of a comedy or a joke, as you described. I found that, although bits of it were funny, I found it also completely distancing and, in a way, a joke on the audience. Because what I did appreciate, as I mentioned from Volume 1, is that it brought ideas into this concept that von Trier is playing with. So it wasn't just provocation. There were some ideas there. But as Seligman, the Skarsgård character, continues to offer these intellectual theories as to why she may be behaving this way or what they might mean, or even what,
and all the fly fishing metaphors,
how it might be connected to things, those become increasingly absurd. There's one here where he goes into a comparative history of the Eastern and Western Christian church and brings that into it. And she begins to, the comedy curdles here because she begins to become derisive of him. She's laughing at some of his metaphors. At one point says something like, "I think that's the most ridiculous digression you've offered yet."
That is just simply a screenwriter talking to himself.
It is. And it's also telling the audience all the effort that you've put in to considering what this movie might also be about was worthless because we don't really mean it. We're just joking around. And so it's a bit of an affront. And it also, for me, it makes the movie fold in on itself.
Yeah, I agree. And I did find in Volume 1, Josh, that von Trier's sense of humor is fairly astutely deployed for the story it's telling. Now, one can argue about the story up and down, but it's about the right mixture of tones and intentions. I do think in Volume 2 it gets much more sour, much more just physically difficult to watch a lot of what's the activity on screen, especially for the anguish she's going through. And right there you have kind of the weird dialectic with Gainsbourg as an actress and von Trier as this provocateur puppeteer. You know, you have a guy who, you know, is just kind of an adolescent control freak as a director who also has a real visual artist, I think. But it's if I got through the second part at all, Josh, to the degree I went, it's only because Gainsbourg as an actress is just fighting her way to get to some kind of truth in this part that, as you say, is really increasingly less of a recognizable human character and just kind of a collection, a catalog of sexual experiences.
Well, let me throw this alternative reading out at you because I did consider it as Volume 2 was going on. Maybe I was just looking for some sort of distraction as I was sitting through it. But I thought there's probably going to be a reading here where this is a feminist version. There is a feminist version of Nymphomaniac out there in that, and it's very much just along the edges, but maybe you could see Joe as this figure of self-determination who's being literally beaten down by this hypocritical and patriarchal society. And that is where the punishment might come in as well. It's more to depict her as a sympathetic figure. Now, it's one that didn't last long in my own head, particularly because Seligman, who increasingly becomes a clown figure, I think, as this movie goes on, he proposes this theory himself. And so just the fact that he's putting it out there and at this point he's kind of a joke makes me think, I can't put a lot of weight behind it myself. But some people might read the movie that way. Do you lend any credence to that at all?
I think, I mean, is it a feminist work or can it be read through a feminist lens? I mean, God knows it's not a feminist work. But I think where von Trier really falls in the traditions, I think, are more in the line of what Franz Wedekind, the playwright, did with the Lulu trilogy. And we'll talk about one of the movies made from that later. But it's really more about this archetype of the unruly, uncontrollable female sexual urge and then all these sort of helpless moths, these males, you know, male kind of characters spinning around, unable to kind of like get away from the flame in time. Even Seligman, who's the avowed asexual, is ultimately, as you can kind of tell where it's going anyway, ultimately he's going to be sucked into this, under this vortex too. Dramatically, you know where that's going. So therefore, it sort of doesn't really work dramatically. And he's got an oddly, as you say, puritanical, he's got kind of a stodgy sense of how to develop these characters. And as far as female punishment, he can't get enough of it. It is the thing. It's his Achilles heel, I think, as a filmmaker. You know, everything from Dancer in the Dark to even the underrated corporate comedy he made, The Boss of It All. There's a lot he's either kind of dealing with or just exploiting. If you had an actress any less good than Gainsbourg, I probably wouldn't even gotten through part one, which I like, but it's quite a bit better than part two, what I've seen of it.
Well, and for me, yeah, the female punishment spoke most loudly. Whatever other readings there might be of the film, that's what I heard the most clearly. Nymphomaniac is currently out in limited release. It's also available on demand. If you do watch it, let us know what you thought. If you made it through all two volumes, feedback@filmspotting.net is where you can send your thoughts. You can also leave us a voicemail. The number for that is 312-264-0744. And we are on Twitter @filmspotting and at facebook.com/filmspotting.
We'll ask listeners to assess the career of Scarlett Johansson next as part of the Film Spotting poll, and I'll share a few thoughts on Captain America, The Winter Soldier.
Black Widow is some of ScarJo's finest work.
Stay with us.
Good sex never makes you feel hollow. Good sex never makes you feel clean. Good sex is gonna get you with a fun line. Good sex is gonna die. But I'm still breathing with you, baby. Yeah, I'm still breathing with you, babe. Good sex, it's gonna take you in the high life. Good sex, it's gonna take you actually. Good sex, it's gonna get you in the fun life. Good sex, it's gonna die. On the knees. Oh, but I'm still breathing with you, baby. Yeah, I'm still breathing with you, baby.
Hey, Film Spotting listeners, Prodigal Son Adam here with a quick note for our Chicago area listeners that on Tuesday, April 15th, there's going to be an advanced screening of the movie The Railway Man. This is based on a true story about a British prisoner of war in a Japanese camp during World War II. It stars Colin Firth, Nicole Kidman, and Stellan Skarsgård, based on a best-selling novel. It opens Friday, April 18th in Chicago and select cities. But on the 15th, a few days prior, they're going to have that free advanced screening, and we're giving away a few Admit 2 passes. All you have to do is go to gofobo.com, that's gofobo.com/RSVP, and enter the RSVP code FILMSP1SGT. FILMSP1SGT. And if you miss that, just go to filmspotting.net in the notes for this show, and we'll list that code and that link if you want to attend.
Girlfriend, really?
Oh, I don't have a girlfriend at all.
Very charming. Handsome face.
Aye. Yeah. Thanks a lot, cheers.
You think I'm pretty?
Aye, you're gorgeous.
Do you?
Aye, definitely.
Good.
Welcome back to Film Spotting with Michael Phillips. I'm Josh Larson. You may have had a hard time making out the Scottish brogue in that scene, but the more familiar voice you may have recognized was Scarlett Johansson's, playing an alien seductress preying upon hitchhikers in Scotland in director Jonathan Glazer's much-hyped new film Under the Skin. We've got an interview with Glazer on next week's show, but this week's poll question has us asking about Johansson and how she rates as an actress. That's in a bit. But first, the results of the poll question we posed a couple weeks back. Inspired by Darren Aronofsky's recent leap to big-budget filmmaking, Aronofsky's Noah cost more to make than his previous five films combined, we asked you, to which of these young directors, all Film Spotting favorites, would you give $100 million or more to direct the epic of their choosing. Here are the filmmakers we offered as options. J.C. Chandor, who made last year's All Is Lost with Robert Redford, also made Margin Call in 2011. Derek Cianfrance, recent film, Place Beyond the Pines. Previous to that, he made Blue Valentine. Another option was Sean Durkin, the film I love quite a bit, Martha, Marcy, May, Marlene. Our fourth option is a real film spotting favorite, Sarah Polley, Stories We Tell from last year, also made Take This Waltz and the wonderful Away From Her. And then Kelly Reichert, a trio of films in her career so far, Old Joy, Wendy and Lucy, and Meek's Cutoff. And then the director of my favorite film of 2012, Ben Zeitlin, for Beasts of the Southern Wild. That was another option we gave you. Michael, how did the poll come out?
So this was an extremely close result, was it not?
One of the closest ever, I believe, film spotting history, yeah.
Okay, so in sixth place, Sean Durkin of Martha, Marcy, May, Marlene, 9%. Fifth place, Sarah Polley, 14%. Fourth place, Kelly Reichert, 16%. Third place, J.C. Chandor, 17%. Boy, these are tight. Second place, Ben Zeitlin, 20%. And at number one, by a squeaker, Derek Cianfrance for Place Beyond the Pines, Blue Valentine. Give him $100 million.
Yes.
21% of the people said
that. A lot of neck-and-neck tight races going on there. And producer Sam Van Hogren actually said when he called the poll this morning that a single vote separated Zeitlin and Cianfrance and Chandor and Reichert. So people had a tough time choosing among these filmmakers. We also heard from a couple of those who voted. Kevin said, this poll question is a killer. All of these people are incredibly talented directors, and four of them, Durkin, Polley, Reichert, and Zeitlin, have made films that I'd be comfortable listing as among the best of the decade so far. From those four, I'd narrow it down to the two freshman directors, Zeitlin and Durkin. Polley and Reichert are certainly capable of doing fantastic things with a big budget, but they both seem so at home making smaller-scale films that I would reserve the millions for somebody else. I feel similarly about Durkin. The guy's got serious chops, but Martha, Marcy, May, Marlene was more Hitchcock suspense than Spielberg suspense. In the end, I'd pick Zeitlin to win the lottery. I wouldn't say he's the best director in this crowd, but Beasts of the Southern Wild displayed an imagination and inventiveness colorful enough to convince me that Zeitlin could really make that $100 million sing.
Okay, this is from Nathan Marone. Kelly Reichert, he says, directed Meek's Cutoff, probably the best modern Western since Unforgiven, on $2 million. I can't imagine what $100 million would bring out of her. Maybe it would ruin her. Can you imagine John Cassavetes directing with blockbuster budgets? Whatever the risk might be, I'm giving this imaginary money to Reichert so that at the very least, she can stop teaching for a living and make money directing movies.
Well, Reichert got my vote, so I'm with you there, Nathan. Patricia in Portland, Oregon said, I'm going for Sarah Polley. I feel like she has a good head on her shoulders, so her $100 million wouldn't go to waste. Plus, I'm all for more women directors. There's a chance those guys will get $100 million at some point in their career. The women? Not so much.
Martin Cuevas from Brooklyn, New York. All these directors have accomplished so much with so little. Maybe split the $100 million between all of them and let them produce more outstanding works. And in fact, you know, Josh, you know what would really happen. All these directors, if they had the $100 million, they would simply divide it up into at least seven or eight projects so they would actually have a career they could
map out for the next 20 years. Yep, and probably make some pretty amazing films with that money, too. Well, thank you to all those who did vote and also shared some comments in last week's poll. We have a new poll question up for you at filmspotting.net. And it's about Scarlett Johansson. We're going to give you a couple of options here describing where she stands at this point in her career, at least in your estimation. Michael, do you want to read the options we have?
The options are Scarlett Johansson is my favorite actress, one of the best of her generation, fine in the right role, or she's got looks but no chops.
Yeah, and to put one of those options in context, one of the best of her generation, consider that she's 29, so her peers are actors like Carey Mulligan, Keira Knightley, Rooney Mara. That might help you kind of decide if that's really where you want to go. I don't know how many people will go with one of the best of her generation. I happen to like her as an actress and have for a while more than I know Adam does, though I think he's coming around with some of her recent performances. When you look at these options, Michael, where would your vote go?
I mean, it's such a kind of a shruggy sound to the thing, but fine in the right role. I mean, better than fine in the right role. I think quite good in the right role. And intriguingly, she's got stage ambitions, too. And I haven't seen her on stage myself, but she was in the revival, well-regarded revival of A View from the Bridge with Liv Schreiber. That's a good sign because I think anybody who's taking the stage seriously as well as the screen work is going to develop as an actor. So for now, maybe halfway between finding the right role and one of the better of her generation, yeah. Not best.
That's pretty much what I'm thinking, too. It does feel like a backhanded compliment to say finding the right role. But I think what Sam Van Hogeren, who put this poll together, is probably getting at here is that she does seem to require that opportunity. She's not someone that you could just throw in anything and she's going to thrive. And I think actually the reason she gets a lot of criticism is because some directors don't use her well at all. Mm. They may just rely on her physical attributes, right, and emphasize that. And so she does seem to need that opportunity in order to do her best work. So I would probably vote that way as well. Please do share with us where you think Scarlett Johansson is in her career. Again, you can do that at filmspotting.net. Just a quick note here about bonus content this week. Michael and I are going to hang around a little bit to talk about one or two things. We did ask in our review of Muppets Most Wanted, we were curious about what kids thought about that movie, and a listener wrote in with a very brief kid review of Muppets Most Wanted. We'll share that. And also we did get some feedback on our actor-director pairings top five. We did that in connection recently with the film Enemy, which was a reteaming of Jake Gyllenhaal and director Denis Villeneuve, or if you're our listener on Twitter and you prefer Denis Villeneuve, you could go that way as well. To get our bonus content, go over to filmspotting.net and you can find information about the Film Spotting app. That's the easiest way to get that content. The app is available on iPhone or Android or Windows 8 phones. Again, just go to filmspotting.net and click on the apps link.
Most of the intelligence community doesn't believe he exists. The ones that do call him the Winter Soldier. He's a ghost. You'll never find him.
More Johansson there as Natasha Romanoff, a.k.a. Black Widow, in the trailer for Captain America, The Winter Soldier. These are the continuing adventures of Captain Steve Rogers. It's a sequel to 2011's Captain America, The First Avenger. I have not seen The Winter Soldier yet, Michael. Captain America, the previous film, was one of the better ones, I thought, of this Marvel series, though it did trail off at the end there into an extended trailer for other Marvel movies, yeah. I felt. And at this point, I feel like I need one of those because I'm not immersed in this Marvel comic book character world, though I like many of the films. I need one of those big boards, you know, that the FBI has in movies for the mafia, where they've got the guy on top and the strings are connected. I want that for all these Marvel characters. That would help me out a little bit.
Or like Tim Russert with his pointer at the presidential elections. Just saying,
get a little more technologically advanced
now,
that way.
Now the Tesseract affects the following characters.
Wouldn't
yes.
that be helpful?
Yeah, it would be.
Well, apparently I do know that Winter Soldier does involve a Russian villain. And given the recent events in Russia and Ukraine, that seems pretty timely. Does Captain America have anything interesting or something else on its mind along those lines? Yeah. Or is this just a comic book flick?
Well, it is one of the better ones, I would say. I was very fond of the first one, actually. And along with the first Iron Man, it's the two that I would actually put above the level of pretty good.
Okay.
I mean, I found the first Captain America better than pretty good. It was the director, Joe Johnston, also made The Rocketeer, and he's just simply had he has my kind of nostalgia and my kind of ideas about how to film and frame action in a comic book, honoring comic book material that still feels like a movie. This new one, the new Captain America, is much more like a Michael Bay, Paul Greengrass mashup. It doesn't have any old school anything about it.
Did Johnson direct this one as well?
No, the Captain America sequel was directed by a sibling team of Anthony Russo and Joe Russo. They haven't made a feature film, Josh, in several years since, I think, 2006, You, Me, and Dupree.
Oh, yeah.
And they've done a lot of series television in the meantime. I think what's good about the film is that a lot of the plotting is sort of intriguing and interestingly conflicted, in that there's more than one adversary going on here. I don't want to give too much away, but you're dealing with kind of the specter of American might and right run amok, and this sort of image of America's totalitarian worst instincts really kind of ruining things for the planet potentially. This is the reason, I think, Josh, movies like Avatar, selling kind of the same image of this fearsomely militaristic American you know, impulse, this sort of murderous impulse. This is why these movies are huge globally. It just is, because it gives you everything you like in a Hollywood movie and in a comic book movie in the Marvel constellation, but it also gives you that sort of undertow of dread and the image of America kind of not the beautiful, right?
Yeah.
And I think this is why these movies kill overseas, you know? I mean, look at the first All-Star Avengers movie just from the other year. That was $1.5 billion, you know?
Yeah.
And I think the movie's interesting for all those kind of somewhat complicated geopolitical, you know, moments. And it's also just basically got enough breathing room in between these crazy, overscaled, frenetic action sequences that are shot and cut to within an inch of their life that you actually notice, hey, Chris Evans, Scarlett Johansson, Robert Redford as the head of the or one of the members of the of this World Security Council and an overseer of the secret op group SHIELD. Evans, Johansson, all these actors, even Samuel L. Jackson seems fairly engaged and fresh this time, and he's done this part a million times of Nick Fury. In between this sort of onslaught of action, which I'm frankly a little less interested in, I think this new Captain America has breathing room and moments that are actually engaged and handled well by the actors. Evans, you know, is he the world's greatest actor? No, he's pretty good for what he is. Johansson, I think, actually gets something to play that she didn't get to play the other time she's played Black Widow. It's just simply got more time to develop sequences and relationships that I think add up a little bit for people like me who are maybe like you, Josh, too, a little bit ambivalent about this whole universe at this point. Do you feel a little weary with the whole thing?
Yeah, I feel a little overburdened by it.
Even when they're good.
Right,
you know,
right.
You think, okay, pretty good, you know,
well,
but.
I got to say, too, you know, you do make a good case for it, but just describing it as having that different tone from the original one in losing that lo-fi sensibility that Johnston brought to both Captain America and The Rocketeer, which is really a lovely film, it makes me a little leery of this one, too.
But, yeah, this is a pummeler. I mean, it's pretty good for what it is, but it is assaultive, and that's why it's going to be big, I think. I just think that's kind of where audience taste is. That's where it's perceived to be, and it pays off that way.
Well, Captain America will be out in wide release this weekend. If you see it, do let us know what you thought. Send an email to feedback@filmspotting.net or leave us a voicemail, 312-264-0744.
For our lists of the top five sex-obsessed movie characters, Josh and I were going to just name the entire cast of Spring Breakers, but that seemed too easy, so we went in another direction. The Film Spotting Top 5 is next. Stay with us.
Get the body butter, baby, let's go party all alone. You can feel the lights that coming on and off and on. Fade is a horrible song. Get the body butter, baby, let's go party all night long. You want my hands out. You want my hands out. We'll take the hurting with the semen.
This is Colin Trevorrow, the director of Safety Not Guaranteed, and you're listening to Film Spotting.
Why do these tapes all have women's names on them?
Well, I enjoy interviewing women more than men. Oh. It's iced tea.
Thanks.
Do you want some lemon?
No, this is perfect. This is perfect. So all of these are interviews, huh?
Yes.
Can we watch one?
No, I'd, no.
Why not?
Well, I promised each of the subjects that no one would see the videotapes except for me.
What are the interviews about?
The interviews are about sex.
Sex?
Welcome back to Film Spotting with Michael Phillips. I'm Josh Larson. That was Andy McDowell and James Spader in Steven Soderbergh's Sex, Lies, and Videotape. You've got a stash of interviews with women talking about sex. Yes, this qualifies you as sex-obsessed movie character, which is our top five this week. Earlier in the show, Michael and I reviewed Lars von Trier's take on the sex-obsessed nymphomaniac. Michael Soderbergh's Sex, Lies, and Videotape didn't make my list. I'm told it didn't make your list. We're guessing it might have made Adam's list, so we wanted to give it a little bit of a nod there. When you did choose titles or characters, more specifically, for this week's show, what did you have in mind? What qualified as sex-obsessed for you?
Here's how I looked at it, Josh. I'm not dealing in the realm of something like sex addicts only. Do you know what I'm saying?
Yep.
And I'm not necessarily interested in most screen portrayals of the typical sex-addled, multi-directionally horny American male teenager, guy.
Could have made a list of just those.
Yeah, right. It's you have to really come up with something interesting in that realm to even make it half interesting. But simply just characters whose sexual compulsions or drives are really driving the character and driving the film somewhere interesting.
Okay, so where does that leave us for your number five?
I didn't get anything.
You didn't have any?
No, nothing.
Just, okay.
No. I like the theory.
I guess I'll fill the rest of the segment then.
My number five. Actually, you know, when I look at my list, Josh, my list goes in reverse historical order. So this is a nice, neat progression.
Unintentional, though, huh?
Yeah, backwards. Yeah, in fact, you know, my number five for me is the Stanley Kubrick version of Lolita, 1962. And I love it for this list mainly because everybody in it, the character played by James Mason, Peter Sellers, Sue Lyne, Shelley Winters, they're all jonesing very, very badly for somebody else. And this is where this is where Nabokov takes the story. I think mainly what I remember the first time I saw this is I'd never seen James Mason do this kind of part. I think I saw this in high school or college first, just to see him this really feverish, funny, but completely sincere portrayal of a middle-aged man caught in a really unseemly grip, where he spies this nymphette, this young teenager played by Sue Lyne, who's I think 12 in the novel, but they bumped her up to 14 or so for the film. It's done in a way that is completely discomforting and just makes you squirm, but Kubrick is enough of a filmmaker and also enough of just a stone cold, ice cold satirist that he just plays right into what people like Mason and particularly Peter Sellers could do just to get the laughs out of that situation. And when you see the scene where Sellers is confronted by Shelley Winters, who he's had an affair with years ago, and there's just all this wonderful innuendo at this dance, and Kubrick's voice, that distinct sort of New York cadence, is the voice that Sellers is using for the role of Quilty. It's funny in about 15 different ways, and it's all about kind of, you know, it's a great comedy about sexual obsession. I just can't think highly enough.
Oh, it's certainly been a long time.
Certainly has, yes.
Do you know that I've been the local authority on you ever since?
Is that so? Well, that's very sweet of you. Thank you so much.
I'll never forget that intellectually stimulating talk that you gave to our club.
Yeah, it's a magnificent club, really magnificent. Tell me one thing, are you a columnist?
No, don't you remember? Well, that afternoon changed my whole life.
Oh, well, how about that?
You remember it?
Did I do that? Did I?
And afterwards, you know, I showed you my garden, and I drove you to the airport.
Yes, really great fun. Listen.
So you're including the whole cast there.
The entire
of Lolita.
Cast. Okay. But Mason, it's Mason's obsession. It's his loins that are kind of leading the parade.
I see.
Right down to hell. But it's Mason and company.
Got it. All right. Well, for my number five, I have to say I had that same instinct you did about the teenage sex comedies, you know, picking the male character from those. I wanted to avoid that. Mm. Yet I also felt like I should really include American Pie on this list somehow. And that movie actually offered me an out with one of its characters. You know, what we're thinking of immediately is Jim, played by Jason Biggs, or even Stiff Fleur, the Sean William Scott character. They're more the Porky's types a little bit. I think they're very funny in the film, but they are just variations on this stereotypical horny high school guy that we have seen countless times. More representative, I think, of the movie's whacked anarchic spirit is Allison Hannigan's Michelle. And she's the band dork who nonetheless is revealed to have the student body's most, let's say, provocative sex life when we finally get to know her.
And one time at band camp, we weren't supposed to have pillow fights, but we had a pillow fight and it was so much fun. And this one time, we all lost our music and we were supposed to play this song, but we didn't know it. So we just made it up and we kept playing and playing, and the conductor didn't know what we were doing, and it was so funny. So you're pissed about something, huh? You know what I do when I'm angry? I just play some Bach on my flute. It's so relaxing. I learned to do that at band camp.
Hold on.
If band camp, the phrase that Michelle repeatedly references, is a euphemism for sexual activity, and from what we learned toward the end of the film, it sure seems to be, sex is on her mind an awful lot. She is obsessed. I do really like
that
American Pie.
And I like that character.
It's one of those curveballs that that movie throws you that an earlier variation of sex comedy probably wouldn't.
Well, and she's not used as a foil. She's not used just as kind of a caricature of the sort of voracious sexual female. It actually seems like a somewhat plausible.
I don't know what band camp you went to, Michael.
I never went to band camp. Maybe that's my problem.
Well, this is the rare sex comedy that has a little bit of perspective to it. It even has glimmers of wisdom about our sex-obsessed society. I think of the exasperation that Jason Biggs' Jim has when he says, I've never even had sex and already I can't stand it. I mean, Jim is obsessed with sex partly because he feels this societal pressure to be obsessed with sex. I went with Allison Hannigan's Michelle because she seems, as you're saying, more like the real deal. She is actually obsessed with it. So.
Right. Well, yeah. And I think one of the other things I kind of like about that first film, I haven't seen it for a long time, but it's everyone's sort of at their own rate of progression in that film. It's not like, you hit 16 and you're done, you started. I mean, as an incredibly late bloomer, Josh, I always take to films like, sort of in the same vein, a film that did not find an audience, Adventureland. That almost made my list here. Ah. Not because any of the characters are necessarily sexually obsessed, but because they're just besotted in a way. Mm-hmm. The Jesse Eisenberg, Kristen Stewart characters are ultimately sort of so besotted with each other. And this is a little after high school that, they really are on the brink of adulthood in a way. And it just makes the whole thing live and breathe in a different way than kind of that sort of mid high school level, which is played usually for the wrong kind of comedy. But I agree that first American Pie, it's actually a pretty crafty commercial comedy.
Well, American Pie, not on your list though. Adventureland, not on your list. What is on your list at number four?
I'm trying to tone this thing up.
All right. What do you got?
I'm not going to hang around with American Pie. I'm talking about Gun Crazy, 1949. Uh-huh. Okay. This is a Bonnie and Clyde type outlaws on the run. Peggy Cummins plays this sharpshooter who spies a partner in crime in the crowd one day during one of her trick shot performances, played by John Dahl.
How about the crown? Would you like to light the matches?
Well, you?
Almost killed a man once. Shot a little too low.
So did I.
And while in the pre-code era, Josh, in the early 30s, America got used to seeing these very forthright sexual female protagonists in movies, by the late 40s, it was much less common because the production code sort of clamped down on all the bad behavior and a lot of the salaciousness, and everything had to kind of come out in code for a while. But, of course, the film noir genre, which this belongs to in a very kind of scruffy, low-budget way, has ways of kind of getting these same strong innuendos and sexual implications across that I find really in one of the best films of that whole time that I find really comes out very strongly in Gun Crazy. And the Peggy Cummins character, Josh, if you haven't seen this film, and not enough people have, I think, the kind of naked desire she can show just in a close-up, a sweaty close-up, and it's there's no skin. And frankly, a pick like this, it's an antidote to something like Lars von Trier's Nymphomaniac. And I guess after
seeing... how all those old movies work, though. After you see something modern and explicit, it's like...
Well, and after seeing Nymphomania, Nymphomaniac Volumes 1 and most of Volume 2, you sort of feel like you want to go back to when... You want to find the examples where a lot of this stuff got across very strongly in all kinds of very sly and indirect ways. And although I would say there's nothing particularly indirect about Cummins' performance in this, but just the sexual heat of these two characters and the sort of insane metaphoric. Every time anyone picks up a gun, it's like they're all, it's like they might as well be in bed. Even if they're robbing a bank at that moment, it's about 85 minutes of seriously dangerous fun.
So your list is in reverse chronological order. Yeah. So we're going backwards in time. We're already at 1950.
1949.
I can't wait. Yeah, 49, yeah. 49 is it? Okay. Yeah. Well, we'll see what silent films are on your list as we get going here.
Go ahead.
My number four is Paul, played by Marlon Brando in Last Tango in Paris. This is Bernardo Bertolucci's somewhat notorious 1972 drama about a recent widower who tries to exercise his rage by having callous sex in a barren apartment with an anonymous younger woman played by Maria Schneider.
I don't know what to call you.
I don't have a name.
You want to know why?
No, I don't. I don't want to know your name. You don't have a name, and I don't have a name either. No names here. Not one name.
You're crazy.
Maybe I am, but I don't want to know anything about you. I don't want to know where you live or where you come from. I want to know nothing, nothing, nothing. You understand?
You scared me.
Nothing.
One of the most famous movie reviews we have is Pauline Kael's New Yorker take on Last Tango, so I wanted to quote from that. She said it centers on a man's attempt to separate sex from everything else. When his wife commits suicide, Paul, an American living in Paris, tries to get away from his life. He goes to look at an empty flat and meets Jean, who is also looking at it. They have sex in an empty room without knowing anything about each other, not even first names. He rents the flat, and for 3 days they meet there. She wants to know who he is, but he insists that sex is all that matters. So that reading alone shows why I wanted to put this character on my list. Brando's performance here, this is one of his hurricane roles, I think. He's always on the edge in it, grunting like an animal in one scene and screaming at his wife's corpse in another scene. I mean, not every choice he makes here necessarily works, and sometimes his improvised rambling, it leaves you feeling like the only thing you can do is uncomfortably laugh in response. It's almost like a way to reestablish your defenses, and I think a lot of Brando's performances do work that way. Certainly this one does in Last Tango in Paris. So this was a shocker in 1972, especially in light of something like Nymphomaniac again. Mm-hmm. It's probably not so much of a shocker today, but still appropriate for this list, I thought.
Yeah, it's interesting, serious work. Whether or not it works for you, it's just important to kind of realize that not all these letter ratings X, especially, are created equal. And
sure,
and I didn't have anything like the resources to deal with this movie the first time I saw it, when I was, I think, a freshman or a sophomore in college. Back in the repertory days, where you could see a film like this mm-hmm. pretty easily on double bill with something else, but another Bertolucci film. But it's been enough years. I think I should give it another look.
Well, you're listening to Film Spotting. I'm Josh Larson here with the Chicago Tribune's Michael Phillips. We are counting down our top five sex-obsessed characters inspired by Lars von Trier's Nymphomaniac Volumes 1 and 2. You can guess by the title. The character played by Charlotte Gainsbourg in that film, a little bit sex-obsessed. Who's your sex-obsessed movie character at number three, Michael?
Okay, my number three is Sister Ruth, the Anglican nun living high, high up in the Himalayas in the 1947 Michael Powell, Emmerich Pressburger classic Black Narcissus, which is available in just fantastic-looking DVD and Blu-ray right now. And it's worth seeing for the Jack Cardiff cinematography alone, but just... And this is Scorsese, among other people, have pointed directly to the close-ups that this film gives you of this character played by Kathleen Byron as she's caught, as she's mentally unstable. She's thrown into a complete tizzy by the presence of this British agent, Mr. Dean, played by David Farrar. And like the Lorca play, House of Bernarda Alba, it's really just about how a claustrophobic, tightly interwoven group of women are responding as one, as sort of one sexual organism to the presence of this dangerous male outsider. And it sounds corny, it sounds cliched, and it's completely melodramatic and feverish and taken right to the hilt by the directors. But my God, the close-ups you get of that actress when she's really giving full rein to her demons. That was very sexually frank for the time, and it's just one of the most indelible portraits of sexual obsession I've ever seen.
Well, your description and the fact that Grand Budapest Hotel, the Wes Anderson film, references Black Narcissus quite a bit, at least as Adam described, since he's seen the film, that makes me really want to check it out. It's one I haven't ever seen.
And that's one thing you'll never see in a Wes Anderson film is a completely emotionally naked portrait of sexual obsession, right? Right.
Likes to go at that sort of thing a little more obliquely,
yes,
doesn't
yes,
he?
Yes, a little arch.
He does. My number three, it comes from a contemporary film. It's Sideways. And the character is Jack, played by Thomas Hayden Church. This is Alexander Payne's 2004 dramedy. And it really gave Church the chance to show his range beyond some of the sitcom work that he had done before that. His character, Jack, is the best friend of Paul Giamatti's unsuccessful writer. The two have headed up to California wine country to celebrate Jack's impending wedding.
Have you forgotten all the bad times you had with Victoria? How small she can make you feel? Isn't that why you had the affair with Brenda in the first place?
Shut your face. Shut up.
Have you even noticed how Maya's looking at you? Oh, come on, man. You've got her on the hook. Reel her in. Let's ratchet this up a notch. Here, drink some Agua Fria.
Shall we get some dessert?
Why don't we go back to my place? I've got wine, some insane cheeses, music, whatever.
Yeah.
Jack is on the prowl for one last sexual fling while they're up there, but we soon get a sense that this is less a fading bachelor acting out than a genuine compulsion that he has. Mostly this comes through when Jack impulsively goes home with a waitress, gets caught by her husband, and is forced to flee the scene without any clothes. He also leaves behind the wedding bands for him and his fiance that he was watching. And it's one of these scenes. It's one of these funny scenes, but also cringe-inducing moments that Payne specializes in and often delivers in his films. And some people are really put off by those. Not all of them work for me. Generally, they do. And I think this one really gets at the heart of why we're uncomfortable. And Payne likes to put the whole range of sad, pitiable humanity up on the screen for us to laugh more, I feel, out of catharsis than derision, but it all depends how you take it. This scene, I thought, worked really well and captured the desperate nature of the compulsive behavior of this character played by Thomas Hayden Church.
That's a good pick. I really love that film. And I know,
you like that one.
I know an awful lot of people, particularly women, who just find it kind of a celebration or maybe an apology for this kind of chauvinistic, lunkhead male behavior. But I don't see it that way. I just see it as pathetically funny.
Yeah, and pathetically is the word. And that scene of Church when he comes back from this, I believe it's right when he comes back from this and gets into the hotel room with Giamatti and just sort of sits on the bed and just kind of shrinks. I mean, he physically seems to shrink because he's recognizing something I don't think he had before about this side of him. So yeah, I think it does work for me. Yeah.
Yeah. No, it's good. No, I think especially on that, when you look at it, like the aging Lothario, where the act is not wearing so well, and by the way, you're getting married, so you know you better start questioning your behavior or your outlook about things. And it's a wonderful film, beautifully cast.
What'd you have at number two?
Number two, okay, I'm going back in time, back to the pre-code era. Barbara Stanwyck in Babyface, 1933. Now, this is not a character who is necessarily sexually obsessed, but she is, as the studio tagline said on the posters, she climbed the ladder of success wrong by wrong.
That's great. That's
what I love. And it's this saloon keeper, speakeasy's daughter. I mean, she's been raised in this moral and ethical and sexual kind of morass. Where
sounds like she didn't have a chance, Michael.
She didn't have a chance. She was. I mean, seriously, it's amazing what they got away with in the uncensored version of this film. She's pimped out by her saloon keeper father to the customers. Then she hops a freight with her friend Chico, played by Teresa Harris. And this was the kind of interracial friendship you got in the pre-code area, where you have a white leading actress and an African-American supporting actress, and she's not patronized. It's amazing. All that's gone a few years later after the pre-code era is gone. And there's one scene that kind of stands in for all the kind of metaphoric sex that's going on with the literal sex that we imagine happening just off camera. They catch a ride in a boxcar, these two women. They're about to be thrown off the boxcar by one of the security goons. And then there's a series of kind of leering close-ups where, you know, the glove comes off, Barbara Stanwyck comes forward, and then kind of guides him, back to the back of the boxcar, you see the gloves hit the floor, and then you see a hand turn the lamp down low. And it's the kind of salacious series of close-ups that tell the story, and you know exactly where it's going. And the Stanwyck character is like, and some others have written about this, she's like one of the early 30s movie gangsters. You're appalled by the behavior, and you can't wait to see what she does next. And then you know ultimately that Hollywood's going to have to, the story's going to have to, in some sense, kind of bring her up short, or not necessarily punish her, but
we're back to Von Trier.
Back to Von Trier, but in a way. But what's wonderful, Josh, about all those the best pre-code stories where the women really are running the show. They're running, you know, their sex lives are part of the characters, whether they're exploiters or not. It's the kind of dimensional portrait of what's happening at the bottom of the Depression that you just completely believe, even if they're fantasies born of the Depression that show you what women, you know, quote, had to do to survive. And Stanwyck is just, it's like you watch this performance and you think you're watching something acted today. It is that naturalistic and fresh and really, really striking. So if you haven't seen Babyface, please see it.
Well, that lamp scene that you talked about, you brought up earlier, because we initially considered for this top five tied to Nymphomaniac metaphoric sex scenes, which were exactly that, where some sort of image or sound or something like that.
So I'll give you one. There's one. Yeah.
And that's a great one. We ended up putting that aside. It proved to be a little hard to put together, but maybe down the road we'll get back to that. And then I'll probably steal that pick from you if you don't
excellent,
mind.
Excellent.
My number two comes from 1955, and it's Richard Sherman as Tom Ewell in The 7-Year Itch. I'll admit up front that this is a role that probably cries out for Jack Lemmon. This is directed by Billy Wilder, after all, but Ewell still, I think he gives a funny performance as this Manhattan businessman. Now, like most of his colleagues, Richard has sent his family off to a lake for the summer while he sweats away at work in the city. Unlike most of his colleagues, however, Richard is determined not to take advantage of being a summer bachelor and stray with another woman. Then Marilyn Monroe moves in upstairs.
I just cannot understand people like the Kaufmans. A successful businessman, probably makes $15,000 a year, spends a fortune collecting African sculpture, but he will not put in air conditioning.
I'll bet it was 95 in the bedroom last night, like an oven.
Poor kid, it's awful.
Good night.
Of course, if you wanted to drop by my place for a few minutes, just to cool off before you face that Turkish bath up there.
Well?
I left the air conditioning on full blast. It's cool in there. Probably too cold.
Or maybe just for a few minutes.
Sure. To bring the body temperature down a little.
Richard is obsessed with sex, though, even before Monroe shows up. There's this early scene that's really quite funny. He has this imagined conversation with his wife. She appears in their back garden, and she tells him he couldn't even attract another woman if he wanted to. She's kind of scoffing at this idea that he's going to run around over the summer. And he claims that there have been a number of times where he's had to rebuff women, his secretary, a nurse, and we get these soap opera melodrama versions of these scenes where the money shot is really him nobly resisting. You know, it just goes up to that point where he's going to prove that he can resist. Well, he does give in when Monroe shows up, and Monroe, it should be said, gives a very funny performance here. In some ways, it's the best thing about the film. But when Sherman does give in to her, his obsession changes. It no longer is it sex, but he becomes obsessed with guilt. He even develops this tick. His thumb keeps popping up, which is, you know, a winking phallic touch, of course. So this movie is one that, again, wouldn't put at the top level Wilder films, but I think the fun that it has with the concept and Monroe's performance there, it does work. So Richard Sherman, 7-Year Itch, my number two.
He certainly stands in for a whole generation of organization men, sort of comedies and dramas, where it's all about sort of busting out of the forms you've been asked to stay within.
Yep.
And it came from Broadway. I know there was a Broadway play first, so that was a different
George Axelrod play, right?
And you're absolutely right about Billy Wilder. I mean, I think Wilder was sort of right at the edge of when the censorship started to drop, and he was one of the people who really pushed it. Some Like It Hot, the innuendo where you just see what the kind of sexual torment that the Jack Lemmon and Tony Curtis characters are going through a few years later in a really controversial and pretty fascinating and really pretty smutty black comedy called Kiss Me Stupid, where Ray Walston is just this sexually jealous, tormented husband who just can't abide his wife being seduced by a character played by Dean Martin, and the character's name is Dino. So it's really, you know, this is a very meta film.
Uh-huh.
And I mean, that film was condemned by the Catholic Legion of Decency, and it really felt like that's where you really felt like, well, things are about to change here. Things are, the walls are coming down. And when I think when portraits of sexual obsession in comedies don't have a little censorship to rub up against, you know, to really to kind of like rein them in, it makes it tougher on the writers and the directors to really keep it funny, because you need kind of a
you
frustration
need to be boxed
element.
Into a corner
you need
in a sense
you need
yeah,
a frustration
yeah.
element when it's when everything goes like it does in a Von Trier film, even if you're talking about digitally added genitalia, you know, if you're looking at Shia LaBeouf's junk, or is it a digitally, you know, is it some porn star who's been, you know, it's all, you start wondering about the digital trickery. At least in the older films, Josh, you don't, you know, that's not what's on your mind. Hopefully the situations are on your mind.
Well, that does bring us to our number one picks for our top five sex-obsessed movie characters. Who do you have at the number one slot,
okay,
Michael?
I think Louise Brooks in Pandora's Box, G.W. Papp's adaptation of the Wedekind Lulu plays. That's the one for me that just can't be beat. It's not that it's not so much that she's an obsessive character, but just that she's an archetype of a kind of a Venus flytrap, a man trap, a voracious sort of man eating character. Now, these are all dangerous cliches and potentially very limiting character types to build a movie around, but when you get an actress like Louise Brooks, it just took audiences to places that they weren't ready to go. The film was not a success at the time, and just like Wedekind's plays, the Lulu plays were very controversial at the time. It's just sometimes it's artists like that that kind of show you where things are going to be going 10, 20, 30 years from now. Louise Brooks, like Stanwyck and Babyface, it feels so modern and completely fresh and dramatically alive that this sort of portrait of a woman just kind of careening through her life and all the havoc she's not necessarily creating, but kind of leaving in her wake, it's like nothing else in the silent cinema, and it's like nothing else I've known. But Louise Brooks forever, I say.
Glad you did get us to the silent era there with your number one.
Yes.
I'm going to go much more recent with my
early
number
sound,
one pick.
Early sound for you.
Well,
early sound.
Late sound, I think you'd call it. It's from 2011, actually. It's Brandon Sullivan, played by Michael Fassbender, in Shame.
Oh, yeah.
This is Steve McQueen's second film, also his second with Fassbender, who gave what I thought was the best performance of 2011 as Brandon Sullivan. He's this white-collar New Yorker who's not just obsessed with sex, but seemingly addicted to it, at least if you go by the behavior we see on screen. He obsessively hunts for one-night stands. When that fails, he hires a prostitute. His work and home computers are just loaded with porn. He even watches it while he's eating dinner. And masturbation, it's not just a habit in the film. It's a compulsion both at home and in the office. So we get this really explicit, we're drowning in this guy's behavior in Shame. And it's similar in a way. I wouldn't say it's quite as graphic as Nymphomaniac, but it is similar in the amount it throws at us. And it's also similar to the characterization of the title character in Nymphomaniac, played by Charlotte Gainsbourg and Stacey Martin in the younger variation. It's a brutal, exposed performance, all three of them, what they're doing here for these films. I think it's used to much greater effect. Fassbender's performance is in Shame.
One person for the rest of your life. I mean, you know, you come to restaurants, you see couples sitting together, and they don't even speak to one another. They don't have anything to say. They don't have anything.
They probably don't have to speak because they're connected.
Or they're just bored with one another.
What's your longest relationship? Exactly.
Yes, you can pour. 4 months.
You have to commit. You have to actually give it a shot.
I did. For 4 months.
It's a very physical performance by Fassbender, and I'm not just talking about the sexuality. There's that first shot of him lying in bed. We see him from above, and he's still as a corpse. He's got these dead blue eyes just kind of embodying the feeling of the title of the film. There's also a moment later in a bar when it's really frightening. I find it frightening, at least, when he suddenly shifts from this well-mannered, socially acceptable smile while people are looking at him. It flips over to this targeted stare when he kind of pinpoints the woman on the dance floor and puts her in his sights. That's the one he's going to get. And then during Brandon's bottoming out that happens at the end of the film, as he's desperately attempting to achieve ecstasy, we get this anguished expression that reveals the exact opposite. And Sexier can no longer repress the pain that he's been trying to numb throughout this film. So if you're new to McQueen and curious about him after the 12 Years a Slave Best Picture win, I mean, that's a punishing film in very different ways. It is a little bit the material he's drawn to and the way he works. But still, if that film you thought was a worthwhile experience despite its harshness, then you should check out Shame as well. It's Art of Darkness stuff, but very well done.
Yeah, I have to get another look because I was cooler toward it than you were.
Were you really?
But I do find that it intriguing that this character by design is very close to something like Bret Easton Ellis's American Psycho. Do you know what I mean?
See him turning that corner,
exactly.
And you wouldn't be surprised at all.
Yeah, and the way the mood that they're very deliberately creating there of this this sort of gray beige kind of dread, it really could go there. And I'll give that one a try again.
Well, those are our top five sex-obsessed movie characters. Michael, you mentioned here or there a few titles that you did consider for the list. Are there any others you want to throw out there as honorable mentions?
I'll throw out one just because Tennessee Williams was the hothouse flower of this whole sexually obsessed genre. And I think when you look at the Elia Kazan film version of Baby Doll, and you have Carl Malden as this man who's married Sue Lyons and is, by contract, not allowed to consummate the marriage. This is where all the film's really wormy black comedy comes from, this state of anxiety, sexual anxiety and frustration. And then you get Eli Wallach as the handsome and mysterious stranger who's about to upset the whole situation. That's another film that was condemned by the Catholic Legion of Decency back when. It ran into all kinds of trouble, didn't find an audience, but today it just seems like kind of just a little emissary from a whole other planet. But I love the way Williams was able to kind of deal with all these heightened sexual frustration scenarios and kind of get them all competing against each other in a scenario like that. It's not a major work like Streetcar, but it's really combustible.
Yeah, and these lists, we should note, not approved by the Catholic Legion of Decency. We failed there.
Or condemned, right?
That's true.
Not approved or condemned.
We were not officially condemned. We're somewhere in the middle. My honorable mentions here, I thought about Rita Hayworth and Gilda. I mean, she pretty much only speaks in innuendo in that 1946 melodrama. Christina Ricci's performance in Black Snake Moan. And then another recent one, Gael Garcia Bernal and Diego Luna in Y Tu Mama Tambien.
Oh, yeah, great film.
Those sex-obsessed teens who get a little bit more than they bargained
for. That's the one film that rises above the kind of typical horny teenager genre.
Definitely a different take.
And that was Alfonso Cuarón's early film, I think his third feature. And he's gone on to things like that have no sex in them at all, like Gravity. But we'll see where he goes from here.
Those are our top five sex-obsessed movie characters. We want to hear who would make your list. Send us your picks or any other comments about the show to feedback@filmspotting.net. You can also leave us a voicemail, 312-264-0744, or find us on Twitter @filmspotting and at facebook.com/filmspotting. The big wide release this weekend, Michael, is going to be Marvel's Captain America, The Winter Soldier. I don't know, is all of that necessary for the title? It's not only The Winter Soldier, it's Marvel's Captain America. I mean, this is one thing that annoys me about these movies, I got to be honest.
The colons. You don't like
too
the
many
colons.
Colons. And apostrophes and company names.
They should have their colon taken out.
At this point, I'm pining for Captain America 2. Limited release here in Chicago, Anita, a doc about Anita Hill, who gained notoriety in the early 90s when she accused then Supreme Court nominee Clarence Thomas of sexual harassment. Also, Ernest and Celestine. This was a 2014 Oscar nominee for Best Animated Film. It's about a friendship between a bear and a mouse. Finding Vivian Maier is another documentary. This is about a famed Chicago street photographer. You've seen this one, Michael?
It's a very, really interesting story, Josh. She was working as a nanny for various families, including Phil Donahue at one point. Hmm. But she told virtually nobody in her life about her life as kind of a stealth street photographer. And the work is stunning, and it wasn't really discovered and developed even out of these rolls and rolls of film until very, very recently. And it's a great kind of a mystery detective story about her life. And the work is just really remarkable. So, yeah, it's a good doc.
All right. Finding Vivian Maier, recommended by Michael. We have another documentary here that comes recommended by Adam. It's Mistaken for Strangers, a doc about the rock band The National. It's made by the brother of the band's lead singer. Adam said, cancel the nominations. I'm giving it the golden brick right now. Okay. Well, wow. Guess that saves me a lot of work. Mistaken for Strangers is available now on VOD or iTunes. I believe it's also opening this weekend at Facets here in Chicago. A couple more limited releases here. The Raid 2, sequel to the 2011 action film. And the movie that we discussed in our main review, Nymphomaniac Volume 2, is coming out in limited release. Next week, it's the return of Adam. And during his time off, he's actually been pretty busy for the show. He recorded two interviews with actor Ty Sheridan and director David Gordon Green, whose new film Joe stars Nicolas Cage and comes out next week. The other interview is with director Jonathan Glazer, who made the upcoming Under the Skin with Scarlett Johansson. Those interviews, plus our top five Desert Island directors. We thought a show with two director interviews, it's time to sit down and say, we're going to a desert island. Who are the five directors' filmographies we would take with us? So that one should be fun. Pretty personal lists. We'll have to see how that comes out. Michael, I want to say thanks to you for filling in these past few weeks. Adam gave me the keys to this thing, but I hadn't really had much driver education. So you've really been a patient, easygoing co-host. It's been a lot of fun.
Oh, thanks, Josh. It was fun. I'll be back.
Yes,
I'll be
will.
Back every week, in fact.
So from now on, it's not going to be a monthly visit.
If it's up to me, Adam is really not coming back.
I'll leave that up to you, too.
Okay. Film Spotting is produced by Golden Joe Dassault and Sam Van Halgren. Without Sam and Golden Joe, this show wouldn't go. Thanks to associate producer Candace Griffiths, and special thanks to everybody at Chicago Public Media. Chicago Public Media creates award-winning content about the issues that affect our community, our nation, and our world. More information available at chicagopublicmedia.org. Music this week from Kevin Drew. More information at kevindrewmusic.com. For Film Spotting, I'm Michael Phillips.
And I'm Josh Larson. Thanks for listening.
This conversation can serve no purpose anymore. Goodbye.